Okay, this is Apologetics 2, lecture number 19. We already discussed we're talking about evidence for God's existence, and we already talked about the teleological and moral arguments. When we discuss C.S. Lewis's moral argument, I just want to, I think we touched briefly on Immanuel Kant and how, from practical reason, he said that we need to postulate God's existence to make sense out of God's existence and the hereafter to make sense out of our moral life. I'll just throw out another form of the moral type argument for God's existence. Okay? Moral values exist. We all make moral judgments. We're appealing to some kind of standard. Now, some people would say man is the measure. Man is the standard. That moral values come from each person. What's right for you is right for you. Doesn't have to be right for me and vice versa. That's moral relativism. The problem with that is if the moral law comes from within each person, and everybody can have their own based on their own subjective taste, then one person can't call the actions of another person wrong. And so there's no way to call Adolf Hitler wrong, his actions. There would be no way to call the killing of innocent babies wrong. And most people would want to call it wrong. So then we can move it to the next stage and say, well, maybe the moral laws come from when a group of individuals gets together and they make a social contract. And so maybe it's a society. Maybe a society is what invents the moral law. The problem with that is, if that is true, then one society cannot call the actions of another society wrong. I.e., America cannot call Nazi Germany wrong for the extermination of the Jews and the barbaric acts that they performed. And most people want to be able to call those acts wrong. So now we move... If it's not there, the next stage from separate societies would be, well, maybe it's a world consensus that gives us this moral law, that creates this moral law, and that decides what is right and what is wrong, and we all have to answer to it. The problem there is, number one, what is a world consensus? I mean, it's not like we all have a remote control for our TV sets and we push a button and it votes on what is right and what is wrong, and then you've got people in African tribes and South American tribes who don't even have remote controls or whatever, but you know, what is world consensus? We know the world consensus was wrong in the past, such as thinking the world was flat. If world consensus determines what is right, then the fact of the matter would be that slavery was not evil in earlier centuries, because world consensus, that was just part of life. You know, slavery was just a part of life, whether it was over here in America or in Europe or throughout the world. I mean, you go back even to the time of Christ. And that's usually not... That's usually not a conclusion that atheists would like to draw. But if they're going to say that there is no God, then they're not going to want to admit to the existence of an absolute moral lawgiver who exists above all men. See, and the problem is, when I was at Olympic College, when I was answering questions, when I defended God's existence there, it was in front of a Christian group, but there were a couple skeptics that showed up. I backed those guys into a corner to where one of the guys said, well, the moral law isn't something that's arbitrary. We could find it through the laws of logic. But when I pressed this guy further, I found he was a pure materialist, so only the material realm existed. And then it was real easy to pin them down on that, because even the laws of logic are subjective, are man-made. they do not exist above all men. Even the laws of logic can change. They're human inventions. And so basically there was no place to ground moral law above all men. See, the problem isn't you don't need to add people quantitatively. That's not what the problem is. Somehow you have to get something qualitatively above. We all admit to a moral law that is qualitatively above all mankind. That's why we can make judgments. That's why we can say to a guy, hey, you wronged me. You shouldn't have treated me that way. You know, that's why Christ did not say, treat others the way you know they should be treated. Because he knew we'd step all over them. Because we don't think about other people. We don't put ourselves in the other person's shoes. But Christ told us, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Because you recognize evil when it's directed at you. Okay? So we make these moral value judgments and we act as if it's above all mankind. The problem is, if you have a moral law that's above all mankind, that necessitates a moral lawgiver that is above all mankind. Okay? And so that's another route that a person can take to argue for from the moral argument for God's existence. There is no adequate explanation for the moral decisions we make. I mean, even look at the writings of historians. They always judge the entire world at the time that they're saying. Well, in the you look at a guy like Bishop Spahn. In his writings, he starts slamming the culture as being male chauvinist and homophobic and that type of thing, the culture that Paul came from. And so they're making these judgments as if there's a standard above all cultures throughout history that can stand in judgment on man. So with the Christian ethic, because it's grounded in an eternal, unchanging God, slavery, putting a whip to the back of a black man and forcing him to work for you without any pay at all, is wrong at any day, in any age. We have a universal, we have an absolute moral lawgiver who gives us universal, unchanging moral laws. And this moral lawgiver, since the moral law is above all men, the moral lawgiver as well must be above all men. Before we move on to the cosmological argument, does anybody have any questions about the moral or teleological? Okay. Now, the cosmological, what I want to do first is just give you a real simple one. It's kind of half cosmological, half teleological, and that's Francis Schaeffer's. Schaeffer lived from 1912 to 1984. And he said there's only really three possible explanations for the universe which now exists. Either everything came from nothing, or everything had an impersonal start, or everything had a personal start. And Schaeffer argues that everything could not have come from nothing, because from nothing, nothing comes. He also argues that everything could not have had an impersonal start, because personal man could not come from an impersonal cause. And therefore, he argues that everything, the universe, must have had a personal start. That's a pretty simple cosmological type argument. You could even call it teleological, because it's dealing with the personality of man. But when you it gains its force when you read Schaeffer, because this article is real short and sweet, but he builds on insights, on the insight that he has about human nature and about man, and that which separates man from the animals. And so when he argues that personality cannot come from an impersonal cause, within the context of his writings, it becomes a pretty strong argument. What I want to do right now is look at the three different types of cosmological arguments. You'll see this again on the test, and this is on AP 15. There's Thomas Aquinas, who lived from 1224 to 1274 A.D., Leibniz, who lived from 646 to 1716 A.D., and Bonaventure, who was a contemporary of Aquinas, lived from 1221 to 1274 A.D. Aquinas all three of them used a cosmological argument, but they used different types of cosmological arguments. Aquinas used the cosmological argument based on the principle of existential causality. Leibniz used the cosmological argument based on the principle of sufficient reason, and Bonaventure used the cosmological argument based on the Kalam cosmological premise. And I'll explain each of them as we come to them. First, let's start with Thomas Aquinas. By the way, the reason why I go into greater depth with the cosmological argument, I think it's the most solid argument for God's existence, and it paves the way for the teleological and moral argument to then come in and put the finishing touches on. But Thomas Aquinas, his argument was based on the principle of existential causality. Existential causality means that what Aquinas was arguing for was not arguing for the cause of the beginning of the universe or the cause for the beginning of something. In other words, if you used an argument from the principle of existential causality, if you used an argument for how I got here, you would not argue for my parents as the cause of my existence. They gave me my beginning. That's the Kalam cosmological argument. The cosmological argument from existential causality, that instead would argue that the current causes for my continuing existence, okay, such as I need air to breathe, food to eat, that type of thing. And so the principle of existential causality would be looking for the sustaining cause of all limited existence or all dependent existence rather than the originating cause. The originating cause, the initial cause for the existence of something, that is the Kalam cosmological argument. Okay, so everybody understand on that? Now, can anybody tell me why Aquinas didn't use the Kalam cosmological argument? One of the main reasons why he didn't. Actually, the Kalam cosmological argument dates back even before Aquinas. So it was that advanced, but there was something about Aquinas' philosophical system that would not allow him to even pay lip service to the Kalam cosmological argument.
Didn't the Kalam come from the Islamic, and Aquinas
was the Catholic Church? Yeah, and that's a good point, but at the same time, some of Aquinas' arguments sound almost identical to Moses Maimonides, who was a Jewish philosopher. So he wouldn't mind borrowing from the Muslims if he thought they were right. Jeff?
It's not specific enough if you're going to use for deism.
You would still be able to bring in some other premises. Well, it would be tough for the deist too. There's ways to get around that. There's ways to still make it stronger. Basically, what it was, Aquinas.
He was Platonic.
Augustine was Platonic. Aquinas was Aristotelian, and Aristotle believed in an eternal universe. Okay, so here he's using Aristotle's argumentation. And he would refer to Aristotle in his writings, Aquinas would, as the philosopher, and everybody knew who he was talking about. Okay, So that's the high regard. Now, there are changes that he made to Aristotle in places. But what Aquinas argued that Aristotle was right. You could not prove that the universe, you could not philosophically prove that the universe had a beginning. But then Aquinas would argue, but we know that not through reason, but by faith, because we have good reasons to believe the Bible is God's word. Once we know the Bible is God's word, the Bible starts out by telling us, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. So he accepted that the universe had a beginning on the authority of the Bible, but he did not believe that you could prove that through reason alone. Not so much, because Aquinas is arguing that you could argue, you could defend the scriptures, but what he's arguing that there's certain things, Aquinas, if you remember from the lecture I gave on Aquinas, he put things into kind of two different stories, if you will. He said you could prove certain things by certain truths of the Bible you could prove by reason, and others go beyond reason. There's no way we could prove it through reason. Like God's existence you could prove through reason, but the doctrine of the Trinity you had to accept by faith because you couldn't prove it through reason. And he would also put the beginning of the universe, that the universe is not eternal, as something that you could not philosophically prove. Okay, Bonaventure, St. Bonaventure, who was the contemporary of him, argued with him on that and did accept the Islamic philosophers' usage, the Muslim philosophers' usage of the Kalam cosmological argument. And they actually dialogued back and forth on that. And in fact, in Frederick Copleston's History of Philosophy, I think it's something like volume 3 or book 3 or whatever, but it's on the medieval. When you read in Bonaventure and Aquinas, you'll see how they kind of was like a ping pong match going on back and forth. And Aquinas was a tough dude to beat, but I think except for some bad science from Bonaventure, I think Bonaventure took him to the woodshed on this one. And sometimes we accept the philosophical system to the point where we end up in a dead end. You either reject the system or lose the debate. And I think Aquinas lost that debate. But the cosmological argument, I believe all three of these cosmological arguments are good, solid arguments for God's existence. So I'm not saying that you should only use one or you should use the other, but what I am saying is I don't think, like, for instance, Aquinas would say that Bonaventure's argument is messed up, doesn't really work. William Lane Craig would say, no, all three of them are okay. That's what I would say. Geisler would say Aquinas' argument from existential causality is by far the best. Leibniz has some real problems, Geisler would say, and the Kalam cosmological argument has some problems too, but there's ways to get around it. But Geisler will use premises from the Kalam cosmological argument within his argument from existential causality. But keep in mind, if you need to just jot this down next to them, by existential causality, you're looking for the current sustaining cause. The current sustaining cause. Okay? It's kind of like when I look at myself, my face, in the reflection in that window, I am the sustaining cause of that reflection, so that if I moved my face in front of that window, the reflection would also disappear. Now, that'd be pretty tough for me to prove to myself, because every time I'd go back to look at it, my face would be there. So what Aquinas is arguing is that if God is not here right now holding us in existence, sustaining the universe in existence, the universe would cease to exist immediately. And what I'm saying is he's right on with that, but that still doesn't mean that you can't argue for the beginning of the universe like Bonaventure. We'll get to that a little later. Leibniz, he's arguing for the sufficient reason. What he's arguing for, his basic premise, Well, it just point A there. There is a sufficient reason or sufficient explanation for everything that exists. And we'll talk about that when we come to that. And for Bonaventure, with the cosmological, the Kalam cosmological argument, he's arguing for the beginning of the universe. Okay? So keep that in mind as we discuss these three arguments. Okay, let's take a look at Thomas Aquinas, the cosmological argument from existential causality. Okay, we'll look at points A to E, or points A to D. I just put the modern proponent of this argument is Norman Geisler. The first premise is that would be something along these lines. By the way, Aquinas argued his five ways for God's existence. About three of his arguments really fit real close to this. Okay, so it's not, I'm not quoting him word for word is what I'm getting at, but I'm hopefully from my reading Aquinas and from reading the experts on Aquinas such as Copleston, Geisler, and Gilson, hopefully I've got a good enough understanding on Aquinas to his argumentation for God's existence to where I can do this. But point A, premise A, beings exist which are dependent on other beings for their current continuing existence. Okay? If you don't understand that point, you shouldn't go any further. Just recognize what he's saying. There are beings exist which are dependent on other beings for their current continuing existence. Okay? In other words, if you took all the oxygen out of the Earth's atmosphere, I could think of six beings in this, dependent beings in this room that would cease to exist immediately. Okay? And by the way, almost synonymous with dependent beings would be contingent beings or finite limited beings. Okay, all those terms are almost interchangeable. Each one has like just a different emphasis. But I like dependent beings because I think it makes it the clearest in our current vernacular. But beings exist which are dependent on other beings for their continuing existence. Premise number two: dependent beings cannot be the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of other dependent beings. Point number three, and this is where he kind of backs that, adding dependent beings never gives us an independent being. In other words, no matter how many, it'd be like saying, well, hey, I think this was the illustration that Walter Martin gave for this particular argument. It'd be like if you saw a chain hanging down from the sky, and you saw one of the links on the chain, and you said, well, how is this just hanging in midair? Oh, well, here's the answer. There's another link supporting it. Oh, wait, but this one is just hanging on midair. Oh, no, wait, there's another link. See, eventually you've got to get high enough to where you're going to find the nail on the wall or whatever that is holding it up. Okay? It would be the same... what was the other illustration? Domino. I was going to use the domino one, but that's more. It's got a little bit more of a Kalam cosmological emphasis, though. But it's real close, and there is an analogy that can come from it. But it's coming dangerously close to overlapping with the Kalam cosmological argument. When I used to hook up car stereos in the old beater cars that I used to. You know, is a typical guy from New Jersey. You buy a car for $200 that barely runs, and then you go out and buy a car stereo for $450 and try to hook it in there. But you know, you can never get those things to play unless you took that wire and grounded it on some metal. But, you know, supposing you took the wire and grounded it onto another wire, it still wouldn't work. And then you can go on and on infinitely to other wires. If it's not grounded to metal, it's not going to work. And that's the way it is with dependent existence. If dependent existence is not grounded in totally independent existence, it would not exist at all. That's what Aquinas is arguing. So we take, if the universe is made up of dependent beings that depend on something other than themselves to, for their continued existence, to sustain them in existence, if you add up all these dependent beings, it does not give you an independent being. What it says is the whole entire universe needs a sustaining cause. And so his conclusion, point D, is the ultimate cause for the continuing existence of all dependent beings must be an independent being. Okay? I try to simplify Aquinas' argumentation. If you get a chance and you are able to get your hands on his Summa Theologica and you want to look at his arguments, his five ways to prove God's existence, you'll see that it's almost like he's speaking a different language. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And what's that? Well, yeah, he actually wrote in Latin, but I mean, you just even the translation of it in English, which is the only way I read it, it sounds like it's a whole different argument. So it's kind of what you have. It's like, what is holding this book, suspending this book, holding it up about 3 feet off the ground? It's the desk. And that desk is also sustaining this can of tea and this cassette recorder and that type of thing. And that's what Aquinas is looking for. He's looking for that independent being that holds all the things in the universe together, which the scriptures talks about Jesus doing, the one who sustains in existence all the dependent existence. So that's Aquinas' argument from existential causality. Now, Leibniz's argument is from the principle of sufficient reason. Now, the principle of sufficient reason is point A. There is a sufficient reason or a sufficient explanation for everything that exists. Okay? Now, Geisler will argue that we need to bridge the gap. You see, Geisler is very empirical. He's a philosopher who's got his hands in the dirt. Okay, he's got his hands in the world of the five senses. Why is Geisler like that? Because Aquinas was like that, and Geisler was a Thomist. And I'm not knocking that. The Thomists are pretty tough to beat in debates. I think Aquinas was great at what he did. But keep that in mind. So Geisler doesn't like explanations in the mind. He wants causes, concrete causes that exist outside the mind. Okay? My argument there, though, is if the only adequate explanation turns out to be a cause that is outside the mind, the difference, it's a little bit more than semantical, but I think you still end up pretty much at the same point. So I think Geisler makes a bigger point out of it from a Thomistic standpoint. There's good reason for it. But then again, if you're not a Thomist, there's not that overwhelming motivation to move in that direction. So that's number one. But then later on, Geisler argues, when Leibniz closes his argument, that there must be a being, a self-explained being. Geisler says, well, self-explained being, an explanation, there's no difference between a cause and an explanation, so a self-explained being is the same as a self-caused being, which is impossible because a being would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to cause its own existence, and so therefore he throws it out. Now, the problem I have with that is Geisler, and this is in his Philosophy of Religion, on one page he's saying, I reject this argument because an explanation is not a cause. They're not the same thing. Explanations in the mind, causes outside the mind. But then 3 pages later, he rejects the same argument because there's no difference between an explanation or a cause. I think what Leibniz, by the way, Aquinas didn't refer, we say that Aquinas referred to God as the uncaused cause, because we just update the language a little. Actually, he called God self-existent, the self-existent being, the self-existent one. That's, to be self-existent, self-existent does not mean that you cause your own existence, okay? It doesn't mean that you're the cause of your own existence. But it means that you don't have to refer to any other being outside yourself to explain your existence. Same with a self-explained being. In other words, a self-explained being in Leibniz's thought, a self-explained being, I do not believe, is a self-caused being. A self-explained being is an uncaused being. Okay, in other words, let's go through his argument and we'll see if we can pick it up here. The first premise, there is a sufficient reason for everything that exists. It's pretty self-evident, I would think. I mean, otherwise you got things just popping into existence out of nothing, with no reason whatsoever. I mean, you know, when's the last time somebody had a knife in their back and was laying down dead, and they said, well, let's not investigate it because there might not be a sufficient reason for that event, okay? There's a sufficient reason for everything that exists. Premise two, the existence of some beings is explained by something other than itself. In other words, to explain Phil Fernandez, you have to explain his existence, you have to bring in his parents, Joseph Fernandez and Angelina Minichino, who got together, had a baby boy, named him Phil. The air that I breathe, the food that I eat, the water I drink, you know, write it down the line. So the existence of some beings is explained by something other than itself. But the collection of all these beings that do not contain within themselves their own explanation, the collection of all these beings needs an explanation. Now, you can't go back forever and ever with explanations. An infinite regress of sufficient reasons is impossible, because then there would be no explanation at all. Here's where that domino illustration would play real well, not only here but also in the Kalam cosmological argument. If you didn't have a first domino that fell, you would have no explanation why these dominoes, the series of dominoes, just keeps falling. Okay? There's no explanation whatsoever unless the first one fell. Okay? So an infinite regress of sufficient reasons is impossible, because then there would really be no explanation at all. Because, you know, if you have no ultimate explanation... By the way, this is what a lot of the existentialists would agree with us on almost everything here. But then that's what they argue. Ultimately, there is no explanation. There's no meaning to life. There's no reason for everything. We're just thrust into existence and racing towards death, and there's no meaning to life. And, you know, but they can't live that way. And I think any philosophy that is not livable should be rejected. And then the conclusion, therefore there must exist a being who contains within itself the reason for its own existence. This being explains the existence of itself and then of all other beings. A modern proponent of this argument was Frederick Copleston. He used it when he debated Bertrand Russell. Back in the 1940s, I believe, when they debated, it was years ago. And he really, really whooped the tar to Russell in that debate, too. What he's saying is that eventually you have to arrive at, it's like, okay, explain, what's the explanation for John's existence? Well, when he starts giving you the explanation, he starts bringing in a lot of things outside himself. And then we go, well, what's the explanation for his parents' existence? Well, bringing a lot of things outside themselves. What's the explanation for the existence of that chair? You bring in a lot of factors outside itself. But eventually you have to arrive at a being when you say, well, explain that being's existence. And they say, well, that being contains in itself, in its own being, it contains its own explanation for its existence. Now, I think using modern terminology, what Leibniz, if you say, well, what is that? If God is the self-explained being and he contains in himself his own explanation for his existence, what is that explanation? His answer would be that he is by nature an uncaused being. He is by nature an eternal being self-existent being who has no beginning and no end, his essence is existence. Okay? Now, I don't know. Essence is what you are. Existence is that you are. Okay? God's essence is to exist. He is pure existence. And just like God is love, but he shares, he gives us love. Okay? So we have love, but God is love. Well, we have existence, but God is existence. Okay? Everything else, there's, you have an essence, you're the dead. That which defines you as a man or as an animal or as a mineral, you have an essence and an existence, okay? But God, his essence is his existence. They are one and the same. He is pure existence, pure actual existence. But anyway, with this, with Leibniz's argumentation there, he would say eventually the explanation's got to stop somewhere, and you have to stop at a being that is such a being that he contains within himself the explanation for his own existence. And that explanation is that God just exists. He just does. I mean, he didn't pop into existence. He always existed throughout all eternity. And so I don't think that Geisler's and Cordovan's objections, I think they're more of Geisler's than they are Cordovan's, because I talked to Winfried Cordovan. He co-authored Philosophy of Religion with Geisler. I talked to him about it, and he didn't seem like he knew what I was talking about. So, Geisler originally wrote Philosophy of Religion, and then didn't want to be bothered with it. Well, Cordovan came along and said, well, let me update a few things. He updated a few things, and then he went down as co-authoring the second revision, the revision of it. Well, apparently, this particular Geisler slam of Leibniz was probably coming straight from Geisler himself. And although Cordovan calls himself a Thomist, I think I'm not totally sure, but I think he'd be more of a Thomist in the sense he's just saying, I'm a traditional apologist, traditional defender of the faith, rather than saying, yeah, I hold to the epistemology, the theory of knowledge that that Aquinas held, and I argue just like a good Aristotelian would argue.
Well, is there a way to say that when it says God is not predicated?
And of course, the predicate is just the word is. I don't know. I haven't heard it explained that way, and I really wouldn't want to touch it. I don't know how that would be defined, and. In other words, if somebody says that God is self-existent, if it's synonymous with self-existent, then I would say, yeah, that's fine, but I'm not sure it would be viewed that way. If I heard it, the first thing I would say is, what do you mean by that? And because I when you first said it, it was the first time I heard it. So, and I could be wrong. Maybe some guys are using that type of terminology. Then again, there are times when I've read Van Til, where he uses the term analogy over and over again, and so I'm thinking from a Thomistic standpoint that he means the same thing Aquinas does, and it turns out he means something totally different. And I wouldn't use that phrase unless I saw that it was being widely used and meaning one particular thing, and you know, in one sense it was real clear. The Kalam cosmological argument, Bonaventure used it, the Muslim philosophers used it before him. He argued that whatever had a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. But you can't go back on and on forever, an infinite regress of causes. That's impossible. Therefore the cause of the universe, the first cause, the ultimate cause of the universe, must be eternal. William Lane Craig is a modern proponent of this. Now, it sounds like a lot of things are being assumed, but not really. They used, the Muslim philosophers were well-schooled in mathematics, and they were just tremendous with numbers infinite. They dabbled in infinite set theory and that type of thing. And basically what it amounts to, in fact, I was going to get deeper into this in the when I get to my own argument for God's existence. And by the way, I use even other more simplified arguments than this, but this will just show you the argument that I'll use a little bit later, point number 7 down at the bottom of, or point number 8, the bottom of page 16. When we get to point, yeah, turn to point D. This will help us out here to exclude. Turn to point D on page 17. Now, even this is a point 2 under point D is actually a mistake. It's a fallacy. I called Moreland teaches it. Moreland, in his book Scale in the Secular City, he has this premise in his Kalam cosmological argument. Craig has it in his Apologetics and Introduction. I don't know if he has it in the updated version. I think I looked in the updated version and it was still there. But I called Moreland up and I told him I thought I found a fallacy with it. And I was really surprised. It was before I ever met Moreland. Moreland said, yeah, I agree with you. And we started discussing it a little bit. And he said that he proposed 3 possible solutions and stuff. And we talked about it and that type of thing. And so I was working on my dissertation. I was on that point, the Kalam cosmological argument. Actually, there an actual infinite set of finites can exist. But it can only exist inside a mind. And since it's infinite, it can only exist inside an infinite mind. In other words, God, being omniscient, knows an actually infinite number of things, but he knows them in one eternal glance, one eternal thought. And that's the only way you can grasp an actual infinite set. Because if God thought like we think, one thought at a time, you could never get, no matter how many thoughts you had, you could never know an actual infinite number of things. Zeno's paradox, to get from this chair to that wall, before I can get from this chair to that wall, I would have to go halfway. But before I can reach the halfway point, I would have to get halfway between this chair and that halfway point. Before I can reach that halfway point, I'd have to get halfway. And what it shows us is that it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite set. Now, the problem there that Zeno was having is that there's only a finite, limited number of actual things between point A and point B. He was dividing them infinitely, so he was dealing with potentialities. In fact, Aquinas is the only guy who really adequately answered. I think it was Aristotle answered it, and Aquinas just carried it on from him. That's what you need. You need to draw a clear distinction between the potential realm, the realm of potentialities, and the actual realm, if you're even going to start what we do today, what we call today modern science. If potentialities are considered as real as the actual realm is, there's no way to explain movement whatsoever. There's no way to prove that movement is nothing but an illusion. By the way, science is heading in that direction right now, but here's why it actually, and Geisler said, does it real well when he uses this in his book, When Skeptics Ask. The two key phrases are, not only do we need the actual and potentials, okay, a potential infinite set of finites, that's clear. I mean, that's just set A is a potential infinite set of finites. Okay, that's what mathematics deals with, numbers. They're potentials, but, you know, Are we talking about seven? If we talk about seven apples, then we're talking about actual apples, okay? But if we just talk the number seven, then we're dealing with potential. So you can have a potentially infinite set, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on and on, okay? But if we could have actual infinite sets that could exist outside the mind, i.e. the concrete things rather than abstract things that just exist in the mind, what would happen is then that would violate the law of non-contradiction, because then it would generate contradictions, which you cannot have. Look at set A, set B, and set C. Set A is one is odd and even numbers starting from one and going on and on infinitely. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on and on infinitely. Okay, that's an infinite set. Set B is also infinite, but it only has the odd numbers, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, on and on infinitely. Set C has just 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, multiples of 10. Let me